This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
The following program is homecrafted and was recorded on November 5th, 2021. We begin our program this evening with a formal land acknowledgement statement. These statements, which appear on websites, within documents, and via the spoken word, have quietly gained momentum the past few decades as a way for companies, organizations, groups, as well as individuals around the world to recognize and pay respect to the indigenous peoples worldwide who have borne the brunt of the brutal practices of colonization of their lands throughout history, and that continue to this day. The main language in these statements has become somewhat universal, and as you'll hear, they acknowledge that to recognize the land is an expression of gratitude and appreciation to those whose territory we reside on, and a way of honoring the indigenous people who have been living and working on the land since time immemorial. It is important to understand the long-existing history that has brought us to reside on this land. Land acknowledgments do not exist in a past tense or historical context, and we need to build our mindfulness of our present participation. It is also worth noting that acknowledging the land is Indigenous protocol. Additionally, a powerful way of showing respect to Indigenous people is to support Indigenous sovereignty. The following land acknowledgement statement was borrowed from the website of the Austin nonprofit group, Future Front Texas, whose mission is to nurture vibrant spaces, resources, and opportunities for women and queer creative leaders in Texas. Quote, "We acknowledge that in Austin, Texas, we are on the occupied ancestral territory of the Tonkawa, Lipan Apache, Gurangkua, Comanche, and Kawatilkins people. We also want to acknowledge and give respect to the various indigenous people and nations who live in the land we now call Texas, specifically the Mayakan Garza Band, Tapilam Kawaltikans Nation, Kirikirish people of Wichita, the Seminole people, the Humano Nation of Texas, the Carrizo Comecrudo Tribe of Texas, the Texas Band of Yaqui Indians, the Alabama Coushatta Tribe of Texas, the Kickapoo Traditional Tribe of Texas, and the Isleta del Sur Pueblo. We recognize indigenous people regardless of federal or state recognition, and we understand this list is not exhaustive and that there are names and nations of people that history is still working to recover and include. We acknowledge and honor the diverse indigenous people's connection to this territory on which we gather and pay our respects to elders past and present." Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 FM in Austin and streaming live at co-op.org. I'm Michelle Manning Scott, guest hosting the program this evening alongside our regular host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Polly Dinnett-Claw, the Indigenous Affairs reporter at the Texas Observer, a position created by the editorial staff in 2020 in an effort to address the historical dearth of reporting devoted to indigenous communities and their stories within the more mainstream media outlets in Texas. Welcome to the program, Ms. Dinnett-Claw.
I just want to thank you both so much for having me on the show today. I really appreciate it. Yat Aisha Polly Dinnett-Claw Yinishia Hulson Ishlando Kiani Bashishin Bitani Dashachedo Ishia Dashanilla Kinhojone Dant Nasha. Hi, everyone. My name is Polly Dinnett-Claw. I am Meadow people, born for Towering House people. I come from Manuelito, New Mexico, and I'm Dinnett.
I know your background. I've read your bio. You've been in journalism for quite a while now. So can you give us a little bit of background on what you've done previously to being at the Texas Observer?
Yes. So I started in journalism pretty young. I was 18 when I got my first internship. And I started at the Navajo Times, which is my nation's newspaper. I come from the Navajo Nation, and it's our local newspaper. And so I got my first internship there. And then after that, I started working for National Native News as an intern. National Native News and Native America Calling. And I did that before moving to actually a community radio program on our NPR affiliate station called Generation Justice. And I was there as a senior journalism fellow for, I think, 4 years, helping to produce a 1 hour radio show every week. And then after that, I went to the Navajo Times. And I stayed there for 3 years as a staff reporter before I came here to Texas to work at the Texas Observer as their Indigenous Affairs reporter.
So what brought you finally to the Texas Observer, and when was that exactly?
I joined the Texas Observer in September of last year. And I came because I admired the work of Tristan Ottone. He is somebody that I had always admired and who I really wanted to work with. And I was really lucky because I got to work with him for a year before he decided to leave and go to Grist. And so it was an amazing year, like being able to learn from somebody that I have admired for so long. And that's really the reason why I came to Texas, was to work with Tristan and to build up the Indigenous Affairs desk. I've only ever done work at news outlets that are by and for Native people. And I thought it would be a great experience to go to a non-Native news outlet and do the same type of work that I've been doing. And to be the first Indigenous Affairs desk in the state of Texas was something that I wanted to be a part of. And with my vast experience reporting in Indigenous communities, because it's really all I've ever done, I thought it would be important work to start doing. And I've had such a tremendous year in Texas, meeting so many incredible people and really getting to know the community here has been so amazing. And so I'm just really happy to be here.
I got to tell you, we've had any number of people from the Texas Observer on the show, Gus Bova, Mike Barajas, and then just last week, Lisa Olson as well. So you're in good company there.
Yeah, the Texas Observer does incredible work. And the folks that I get to work with just teach me so much about investigative journalism, about the history of Texas, the culture, the politics of this state. And it's been such a rewarding experience being in an incredible newsroom.
So up until that point last year, when you took this position, this is your first foray into Texas politics and all that's involved in that.
Yes. So okay. I was born and raised in New Mexico. I love New Mexico, proud New Mexican. And I haven't ever really lived anywhere outside of New Mexico. I did an internship in DC and in New York, but those were for very short periods of time. And beyond that, I went to the University of New Mexico. And I have done reporting sort of like across the Southwest, being at the Navajo Times. The Navajo Nation spans three states, New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah. So I did a lot of coverage in Arizona. And then I also started getting into Utah and Colorado. And so I feel like I've done so much reporting in the Southwest in general. But Texas is this unique place, and I always say this, where it's like a part of the Southwest, but also part of the South. And so I hadn't really ever done reporting in Texas before I actually came here. And so it was like a huge learning gap for me. And Texas is very different than other parts of the Southwest.
Yeah. So were you courted by Tristan Ottone to come to the Observer, or did you just apply and you were chosen based on that? And I guess you came knowing that this desk was being created for a new journalist to come in and take this position. I'm just wondering how it was presented and what reasoning was given for creating this desk, and if there was a stated mission other than the obvious.
Yeah, If you actually go to the Texas Observer website, we have a land acknowledgement page, and on there, it describes the mission of the Indigenous Affairs Desk at the Texas Observer. So we do have a set mission, and basically it's just reiterating that the Texas Observer is making a commitment to reporting on Indigenous communities, hiring more Indigenous reporters and editors, and reporting in a way that is respectful of Indigenous communities. The Indigenous Affairs Desk was the brainchild of Tristan Otto, our former editor, and it was really important to him to create this desk. And I actually applied to be a fellow for the Texas Observer. So that's sort of how I got involved, is I applied for a fellowship. And after I did an interview with the selection committee, which included Tristan plus two other editors, they decided to offer me a job as the Indigenous Affairs reporter.
Got it. Obviously, you've had a lot of experience before you came to the Observer with writing stories for the Indigenous people in New Mexico and the surrounding states. Is there a difference in how you do that now for the Texas Observer versus what you did before? Are you really more geared towards Texas itself as far as the stories are concerned? And obviously, you had your contacts from when you were in New Mexico. How have you managed to source the articles and the leads that you've gotten for the articles you've done here? Did you previously have contacts here in Texas that you just went to, or has this been a whole new ballgame for you?
Oh, no. Texas is a whole new ballgame for me. I didn't know anybody here. I didn't really have any roots in Texas. And for me, I feel like that was the biggest obstacle I had to overcome, because in most places in the United States, I have contacts for folks that I know. I always say this, like, Navajo folks live everywhere. And so in the past has been much easier for me to source and find people and find stories just because of my previous reporting. And at the Navajo Times, we cover the Navajo people, and Navajo people live in Europe. They live in California. They live all over the world. And so I wasn't ever sort of focused on just the Navajo Nation. It was any Navajo person, and wherever they lived, we were covering them and their stories and what they were doing in their work or experiences that they were having. And so coming to Texas, it was more difficult because I didn't really have a lot of folks that I knew. But again, Tristan Autone, he did grow up in Texas and he did spend some time here. So he had a lot more knowledge of this area and this state than I did. And he was able to sort of point me in the direction of who I should talk to, organizations I should get in contact with. And the other thing too is the Native American Journalists Association, we have this really amazing guide for reporting in Indigenous communities. And basically, I followed that format. So look at these tribes, look at their economics, look at the structure of their communities, of their government. And from there, I just started reaching out to Alabama Coushatta, Isleta del Sur Pueblo, Kickapoo Traditional Tribe of Texas, and trying to get in contact with folks there. And also, Dallas, Texas was a relocation city for the Relocation Act. So there's a huge Native population in Dallas. And so getting in contact with them, the Dallas Native community is just so amazing. They embraced me and they just shared a lot with me. And I'm so grateful that I got in contact with them. And some of my favorite stories have come out of just meeting folks in Dallas.
Yeah, I noticed that. So that explains a lot, because I did read the Grieving in Orange article. And then, of course, the most recent one that you did with KNON in Dallas. And I hadn't picked up on the fact that since that was such a big community, that's why all those stories are coming from that particular area of Texas. So that was new to me. I did not realize that. I grew up in Dallas, and I guess it shouldn't surprise me that I had, till this point, never heard of that fact of Dallas history, since I've just, within the past several years, become more aware of how the racism of white culture whitewashes everything and, you know, keeps it from us. It's kind of a thread throughout many of our shows here on Civil Rights and Wrongs, but that's interesting. So the story you most recently did there was interviewing the DJs at KNON radio station in DFW. I did not know about the radio station myself. And like I said, I grew up there. Were there indigenous radio stations in New Mexico when you were growing up? Or was this something that you were kind of like was new to you too?
Oh, no. We have, in my community, I think we have 4 radio stations that are all in Navajo. And they only speak Navajo on those radio stations. So I grew up really seeing myself in the media around me. The Gallup Independent, which is a non-native newspaper, had a Diné Bureau-like reporter for their paper. The Navajo Times obviously was like super accessible. So I grew up in a community where I was reflected in all forms of media. And now, which I think is super awesome, the TV station in New Mexico, they have like a 5-minute news section about news from indigenous communities in New Mexico. And so I knew that these programs existed. In Albuquerque, there's a similar show called Singing Wire, which is very similar to Beyond Bows and Arrows. And when I was an undergrad, I went and I hung out with them and they shared a lot of history with me and they shared so much about their experience in radio. And then also I worked for National Native News, which airs across the country. Native America Calling also airs across the country. So I knew that programs like this existed. And so when I came to Texas, it wasn't a surprise to me that there was a radio show dedicated to Native folks. What I was shocked by is that there's not one in Houston, that I haven't been able to find one in San Antonio, that there's not one in Austin. El Paso has the Isla del Sur radio station. But I feel like that was what was more shocking for me, is that other major cities in Texas, at least from the research that I've been able to do, and I don't want to say confidently that they don't exist, I just haven't been able to find them. So if anybody knows of any other indigenous radio shows in Texas, I would love to hear about them.
You spent the day at the KNON studios. Was there anything more that you gained doing that story that you'd like to share?
I think the best thing that I learned through the process of reporting out that story is the history of Native folks in radio. It was super awesome to talk about the Indians for Indians Hour out of Oklahoma. And I found it rewarding to talk with a ton of people who knew a lot about Indigenous people in radio. And to get the history of Beyond Bows and Arrows, which is the longest running Indigenous radio program in the state of Texas, just being able to capture that history, I think is really important. The reason why I do the work that I do is because I do think that it's really important for people like me who come from an Indigenous community, who understand why it's so important to capture this history written by Natives for Natives. It brings a different perspective. Also, the reason why I said that it's very shocking for me in the state of Texas is because programs like this exist all across the country, in LA, Portland, Seattle, New York City. Most major cities in the United States have an Indigenous radio program of some kind. And so that's why it was sort of shocking for me. I started a list of all of the stations in the United States that aired or had some type of Indigenous programming. And it was really awesome to see so many different cities have Indigenous radio programs. And to be able to see a list and go through like different states one by one, checking everyone's programming, it was a lot of work, which is why I only made it like halfway across the country. But it was awesome. I was really surprised by Portland. They have a 1-hour radio program on one of their community radio stations. And the person who runs it plays like electronic music that's made by Indigenous people. And I listened to the show and there were some people that I had never heard of. There's a person in Salt Lake City, again, learning about all of these other Indigenous artists. It was exciting.
Yeah, interesting that that covers much of the country. And here in Texas, it seems to be lacking. I wonder if it has to do with the fact that there are so few, well, at least federally recognized tribes. I don't think people recognize that there are federally recognized tribes, but there are so many other tribes that make up the communities and spaces here in Texas that nobody's probably ever heard of.
And to follow up on that, Michelle, you know, I'd be the first to admit that my contact with Native Americans is so limited and I feel so ignorant much of the time. But I guess one question I would just wonder, listening to your conversation, Pauly, is you talk about the different tribes, the different nations. In your case, for example, do you primarily identify as Indigenous or do you identify with the nation that is part of your heritage? I'm just trying to get a sense of unity among Indigenous peoples versus individual nations that are within the current United States boundaries. Could you talk about that a little bit?
So I wrote an article about Indigenous identity. And in that article, I talk about how in order to be Indigenous, you have to come from an Indigenous nation. You have to have some sort of roots, cultural ties, familial ties, kinship to a specific Native nation. And if you don't have that, then it calls into question claims to indigeneity. And in the state of Texas, I feel like I'm forever asking myself this question about what does it mean to be Indigenous to Texas? Because so many people claim Indigenous ties to the land. And so it makes Indigenous identity in Texas very complex. But at the Indigenous Affairs Desk, I think it's really important that at the Texas Observer, in order to sort of claim the identity of indigeneity, there has to be a tie to an Indigenous nation. And so to answer your question, like it's both.
You know, I think of the Latino label, for example. I'm a contract employee for AISD. I tutor at Navarro High School, which is 88% Latino. And I suppose the kids would identify as Latino. I'm not sure how the kids identify, but if you ask people about their national heritage, where they came from, you know, many are from Guatemala, many are from Mexico, many are from Asia. People are from all over the place. And I always wonder if the label Latino really serves very well, and if it isn't something that is basically an invention of white people to deal with non-white people. I guess I'm wondering if the same thing is true of Indigenous folks, you know?
I think that indigeneity creates a sense of connection between all Indigenous people, from the Sami people to the Maori to the Anishinaabe in Canada. Indigeneity connects all of us. And that tie to the land, that ties to having a similar history of colonization and genocide, connects all of us. And how do we then support all of the other Indigenous people across the world? And I feel like that is something that is really important to the Indigenous Affairs Desk at the Texas Observer, because indigeneity crosses. It crosses cultures, it crosses borders, it crosses sort of these colonial structures that continue to try to separate Indigenous people and create conflict within Indigenous communities.
Yeah.
Pivoting back to your reporting, I wonder, is there one article for you so far that you've written for the Texas Observer that stands out as impactful to you or memorable in some way? I'm just curious if you have something that stood out for you.
Yeah, I did an investigation into the death of a teenager. She was 16 when she passed away. and her name was Emily Grace Kinderspeidel. And it was a heartbreaking case. It was horrific what happened to her. And I feel like that article really speaks to what I'm trying to do here at the Texas Observer, because this case sits at the intersection of blood quantum, which is a federal policy that was forced upon Indigenous communities to decide who is and who isn't Indigenous, who is and who isn't a part of our communities. For example, the Navajo Nation, in order to be enrolled in our tribe, you have to be 1/4 Navajo. And these blood quantum laws are colonial structures that are trying to diminish our traditional ways of kinship, our traditional ways of deciding who is and who isn't a part of our communities. And that's why Indigenous identity is so complex. Because again, like I said, there are these colonial structures that are trying to push out folks from our own communities because of things like blood quantum. And in this case, Grace didn't meet blood quantum, therefore could not be enrolled in her tribe. And so when she was taken into foster care, she was placed in a non-Native home away from her community. And eventually she ended up passing away in the care of her adopted family. And had the Indian Child Welfare Act applied to her, had she been able to be enrolled in her community, maybe things would have been different. And she would have been able to grow up with her extended family. She did have an aunt who would have taken her in and her older brother, but that didn't happen. And it was a really heartbreaking story to report out. But I think that it was really impactful in the conversations that that article sparked of how do Indigenous communities, how can we change or how can we talk about enrollment in a way that honors our traditional ways of knowing and our epistemologies in deciding who is and who isn't a part of our community.
We're speaking with Polly Danette Claw, the Indigenous Affairs reporter at the Texas Observer. The Indigenous Affairs Desk was created by the editorial staff of The Observer in fall of 2020 in an effort to address the historical dearth of reporting devoted to Indigenous communities and their stories within the more mainstream media outlets here in Texas. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 FM in Austin and streaming live at koop.org. I'm your guest host, Michelle Manning-Scott, alongside regular host Bob Daly. This evening's program was homecrafted and recorded on November 5th, 2021. We're speaking with Polly Danette Claw, the Indigenous Affairs reporter at the Texas Observer, a position created by the editorial staff in 2020 in an effort to address the historical dearth of reporting devoted to Indigenous communities and their stories within the more mainstream media outlets in Texas. Let's continue. So you were talking about the Bloodlines article that was published this past summer, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, that one was rather gut-wrenching, what happened to that poor young woman. The very little I've come to understand about those blood quantum policies does seem to suggest they're very controversial within the Indigenous communities and tend to cloud the issue rather than help and just seem to do more harm than good. I can't remember, was there an investigation into her death? Because I thought there was some suspicion on that.
So the case is ongoing because of the coroner's report, but Grace, despite the family's dissent, her body was cremated. And so that really hindered sort of the investigation. And it's still an open case from my knowledge, but there hasn't been any sort of headway on it.
Switching topics from that very somber one, something I learned about in one of your articles was the Alabama Coushatta use a fire to save the longleaf pine down in southeast Texas. Both a history and environmental lesson in one, and something I'd never heard before, of course.
I absolutely love the longleaf pine. I think the longleaf pine is one of the most interesting trees I have ever researched. And I haven't done that much research on trees, but I can confidently say that the longleaf pine is my favorite. And reporting that story was so amazing because everyone who does work around the longleaf pine, like, loves the longleaf pine tree. They just love the work that they do. They appreciate what the longleaf pine provides for the ecosystem of East Texas and just the history of the longleaf pine, and also like what it means to indigenous communities in East Texas, including the Alabama Coushatta, who use the longleaf pine to make their very beautiful, super intricate, amazing, beautiful baskets. And I feel like that was something that I really enjoyed about doing that story, was just being able to like talk with people who really respected and appreciated the longleaf pine. And in the process of researching that as well, like, I learned about how the longleaf pine ecosystem was very similar to the Amazon ecosystem, where it just fostered such diversity in the ecosystem that was equivalent to the Amazon, and that obviously settler colonization and the impact that it had on the longleaf pine ecosystem. There's only 12,000 acres now of old growth longleaf pine. It literally covered the area from East Texas all the way to the panhandle of Florida, and then all the way up to Virginia. So the longleaf pine ecosystem used to reign over this land. And to think of it now, like, only 12,000 acres of old growth longleaf pine still exists because of colonization, because of the commodification of timber. That was really interesting to learn about this area.
Yeah, again, something I did not know anything about until I read that article. And I was like, wow, that is amazing. You know, I'd never heard anything about the longleaf pine and how much of the United States it actually covered at one point. And like you said, the comparison to the Amazon rainforest too, that's just amazing. And then I also wanted to give you a chance to talk about one of the very first stories you covered for the Observer back in, I believe, the fall of last year, about the deaths of the soldiers at Fort Hood. I'm wondering mainly if there's any new information on that story, because it was kind of compelling in the information that it imparted.
I haven't really gotten an update on what's been happening. The two young men who did pass away, who were indigenous at Fort Hood, were both from my tribe, the Navajo Nation. And the Navajo Nation did send a letter to the Department of Defense asking that they look into what happened, but there hasn't sort of been a response, at least from my knowledge. It could have changed, but to my knowledge, there hasn't been a response or any updates. Yeah.
Well, that's disappointing. Anybody who wants to take a look at that story, it ran in the October 2020 issue of The Observer, or it can be found online at their website in the archives. But it details the suspicious death of two indigenous soldiers at the Fort Hood facility and the resulting investigation into those deaths. Are there any stories that you are working on that you might be able to tell us about that are soon to be published in The Observer?
Yeah, I'm actually wrapping up a story right now, which I'm calling my casino explainer. But really, I go into the history of gaming in Texas. I talk about the case that the Supreme Court granted cert on recently, which is Isleta del Sur versus Texas. And that's going to be heard by the Supreme Court sometime next year. And what I feel like has been really missed by other news outlets and their coverage of this case is a comprehensive history of one, tribal gaming enterprises, how they were established, how they were created, and then going into sort of the very particular case of Alabama Coushatta and Isleta del Sur Pueblo, because in the Restoration Act for both Alabama Coushatta and Isleta del Sur Pueblo, it included a clause on there that said that they could not participate in gaming. And part of that Restoration Act came months after the Supreme Court ruled that states do not have the right to determine whether or not a tribe can do gaming on their lands. So I really go into that history and explain it. And I think that it's really important to understanding why this case is so important and why it's going before the Supreme Court.
And that's coming out next month, or is that going to be online pretty soon?
Oh, that's going to be online here pretty soon. Probably, I think it's scheduled for Monday.
Okay. So yeah, we're recording this on Friday the 5th. So by the time people hear this, it will be online. Yeah. And since you did call out to anybody who might have information for you to look into as regards to the radio stations here in Texas, I wanted to give you a chance to throw out how people can contact you if they would like to do something like that. So give us your email for the Texas Observer or Twitter or whatever social media you want to do.
Yeah, so people can contact me via email. It's just my last name, Denetclaw, DENETCLAW, at texasobserver.org. And I can also be contacted on Twitter. My at is at P, and then the traditional spelling of my last name, which is DINECLAH.
Great. Well, thanks so much for your time. Again, we were really glad to finally have you on so that we could learn more about all the great stuff you've been doing at the Texas Observer the past year. And we'll look forward to maybe having you on again in the future, too.
Yeah, I'm so excited. You know, I love talking about my work at the Texas Observer. I've done so much to build the Indigenous Affairs Desk and connect with Indigenous folks from across the state. And so I'm open to hearing ideas, talking about the different issues that Indigenous folks in Texas are encountering. So please, everyone, feel free to reach out to me. And thank you so much for having me on the program. I really enjoyed it.
Well, we're very glad you could join us, Polly, and wish you the very best in all of your efforts.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's Friday afternoon, and once again, we have Austin Sanders with us, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. Good afternoon, Austin. How's life?
Hey, I'm doing all right, Bob. Enjoying this nice weather we've got the past day or two.
Yeah, the sun's out, and it's a great afternoon. It's kind of matching my spirit since Tuesday evening.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I was ready for, well, I don't know what I was ready for, but I thought it might be closer. I thought it might be a cliffhanger. I wasn't sure if the opposition could get the vote out. And lo right. and behold, it was what, more than 2-1?
Yeah, it was a 37-point loss for Save Austin Now in the supporters of Prop A. A blowout, really, a wider margin than I think most people were expecting. Before early votes started, some of the measures you look at, fundraising primarily, both the opposition and the supporters of Prop A had raised over $1 million. So the money was there. They were both spending it. Although I believe Save Austin Now did outspend No Way on A, the opposition campaign. There's some questions about how strategic Matt Makowiak, that's the co-founder of Save Austin Now and chair of the Travis County Republican Party. There's questions about how strategic his campaign was run in this proposition. But as early vote got underway, looking at the map of who was coming out to vote showed that some of the people that showed up to vote for Prop B, the prohibition on public camping, weren't coming out to the polls again for Prop A, which was a bad sign for Save Austin Now, right? Those were kind of the voters that they were looking to activate again on what they described as a public safety issue, same way they did with Prop B. Throughout the 12 days or so of early voting, it was clear that those voters weren't materializing. So after early vote ended, I think there was maybe less hesitancy among opponents of Prop A. And then, yes, shortly after 7 o'clock, after the early vote results posted, Prop A was cooked. There was no way that Save Austin Now could make up a 30 percentage point deficit from Election Day voting. And yeah, in fact, the Election Day vote only widened their margin of defeat. So it was a blowout, yeah, for Save Austin Now.
Well, to many people's relief, it was interesting to see some of the interviews afterwards. By the 10 p.m. news, both the victory and the Save Austin Now gatherings had already dwindled to practically nothing, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The race was pretty much over shortly after 7 o'clock when the early vote totals posted. I think, you know, the interesting question now will be, what does Save Austin do next, right? Before Prop A, you know, after winning the Prop B election by about 15 percentage points, I think Save Austin Now had this view of itself that it was a new political force in Austin, that they, you know, represented conservative voters and were able to give them a voice in ways that has not really been accomplished in Austin citywide politics over the years. But now there's a real question of whether that's true or not, with, again, a 37-point loss in Prop A. So I think that'll be the next thing to watch, is how Matt Mikowiak respond to this really devastating defeat. In his kind of concession remarks at the inappropriately named Victory Night Party that Save Austin Now held Tuesday night, he kind of indicated that Save Austin Now would put up a candidate in the City Council District 4 special election. This is triggered from Councilmember Greg Kassar formally announcing he's running for Congress in the seat that was occupied by Lloyd Doggett. He's running for a different district, Lloyd Doggett is. But once Kassar leaves, or rather with Kassar announcing he's leaving, there's going to be a special election to fill that Northeast Austin City Council seat. Mikowiak said they're going to put up a candidate. He talked about the mayoral election, which is going to be held next year, that Save Austin Now wanted to put up a candidate. But we'll see who he can find. You know, I have to think that raising $1 million and losing by 37 points is going to really put a damper on donors' ability, at least the big mega wealthy donors, on Mikowiak's ability to deliver electoral victory, right? Prop B, kind of an outlier. It was a bipartisan issue in the sense that a lot of voters were fed up with seeing tents under overpasses and in parks, right? And clearly, Mikowiak was not able to activate voters in the same way. It was Prop A, police staffing was not a bipartisan issue in the way that the prohibition on public camping was. So I think it'll be interesting to see how the group responds electorally in the near future.
And you just got to wonder, I mean, Greg Kassar, I think, has been pretty popular up in that district. In my mind, he's been about as far left as anybody on that council. So
right.
I just wonder if they're being realistic about that. That's all.
I was curious and looked up the 2020 election results. That's where Kassar was reelected. He won 70-something percent of the vote. You know, I mean, he blew out the Republican challenger that the Republican Party, local Republicans, endorsed and put up. It wasn't even close. And already there's a candidate, you know, who said he's interested. Chito Vela, he's immigration attorney in town, well-respected. He ran against Cheryl Cole for a state House of Representatives seat, lost to Cheryl Cole for that seat, but he's really well-liked, a lot of policy experience. He's a good fit for that district, so he's already expressed interest in running. If he makes that decision, he's going to be a tough candidate for the Republicans to beat. So we'll see what happens in that election.
Cheeto's been on the show here a couple times. He's an immigration attorney, and I actually first met him through Workers' Defense Project. He was the board chair there for a while.
Right. Good guy. Yeah, really smart, compassionate guy with the work he does, helping immigrants and families of immigrants.
I was talking to Jim Harrington earlier, and one question he had, maybe you can address this, I'm not sure, but do you have any sense about where the support from Prop A was coming around the city? My guess is a good bit of it in Northwest and far Northwest Austin.
Yeah, I haven't done a close examination of the precinct maps, but yeah, most of the support was West Northwest Austin, which as we know, and parts of Southwest Austin, which as we know are the more conservative parts of the city. But the big difference is they just didn't go for Prop A as much as they went for Prop B in May of 2021, the public camping prohibition. So it kind of geographically, it was about, you know, similar spread with much less intensity, which was the big difference for Prop A in this election.
Well, it'll be interesting to see where Save Austin Now goes next. And if this didn't just take all the wind out of their sails, or if there's some other surprise waiting for us. So I guess time will tell on this one.
Right. We'll see.
In the meantime, you've got another story in the current issue of the Austin Chronicle that just came out, dealing with the sex crimes unit at APD. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah. So this has been a story that's been unfolding for the past 6 or 7 years, really. The failures of the Austin Police Department at handling, responding to sexual assaults, right? There are two big scandals that came to light in the past 5, 6 years. One being all of the failures at the DNA crime lab, the mishandling of rape kits, the technicians responsible for ensuring they are preserved were improperly trained, just didn't have the right skills to do this work. Some of the kits were just stored improperly, ended up growing mold. And so they're basically useless at that point, had to be thrown away. So this was a big scandal that started under former APD chief Art Acevedo. And the scandal that followed was known as the kind of clearance rate scandal. And basically what the clearance rate refers to is how detectives within police departments close out criminal investigations. And a national investigation uncovered that APD was improperly clearing sexual assault investigations, which means they were basically saying in some cases the victim of a sexual assault didn't want to proceed with criminal charges, wasn't cooperating. So the detective clears the case, which kind of, you know, makes the department look a little better, because it's not a failure to apprehend the suspect. It's the victim didn't want to pursue the case. But it's come out that many survivors of sexual assault did not want their cases closed, cleared this way. They wanted to pursue them, but were not getting the support from investigators within the sex crimes unit that they needed. And in fact, these scandals have resulted in lawsuits against the city of Austin. And one of them, Art Acevedo and his successor, former APD chief Brian Manley, are named defendants, right? Very clearly linking the role APD played in failing survivors of sexual assault. So these scandals have been brewing. City Council had responded in 2019, ordering audits of the sexual assault kit, the rape kit backlog, wanting to change other aspects of how the department responds to sexual assault. And so, of course, it was a big issue during the confirmation of our new chief, Joseph Chacon. You know, as we've discussed, he was confirmed September 30th by council. One of the council members that voted against him, Allison Alter, really focused her questioning on the sex crimes unit, particularly the lack of training that detectives receive once they're moved into the unit. And as I found reporting the story, there is no formal training for investigators in the sex crimes unit. And this is really concerning for advocates, for survivors, and survivors themselves, because sexual assault is a really complex crime, neurologically and just within society. And what I mean by it being complex neurologically is the way that victims of a traumatic event like a sexual assault, the way that they respond to that trauma, it kind of is not what people uninformed on the neuroscience would expect. Some examples I heard, a victim of a sexual assault being interviewed by a law enforcement official, they may laugh at the law enforcement official, or they may act out in anger at the law enforcement official. And those are normal, predictable responses to trauma. But an officer or a detective who doesn't know that may interpret that as signs that the victim doesn't want to cooperate with an investigation. And right. That kind of contributes to this culture of disbelief that surrounds victims of sexual assault. And this is kind of the societal problem, that there is so much disbelief associated with these crimes in ways that don't exist in other crime types, right? When someone is robbed, the kind of natural reaction is not to say, well, or imply, what were you doing to deserve being robbed, right? This is kind of the reaction that many victims of sexual assault endure, right? Were you drinking too much? Were you out too late? Was your clothing revealing? These kinds of things are hurdles that victims of sexual assault have to overcome before even deciding to report their crime. So these are problems within the sex crimes units, not just at APD, within law enforcement across the country, right? Law enforcement broadly has not responded well to investigating these types of crimes. But given the recent scandals at APD, it's a particular area of focus for advocates and advocates for survivors of sexual assault and among some council members, especially those like Allison Alter, who have really led the charge into changing the way the department responds to these types of crimes.
Just to remind our listeners, it was a little over a year ago, it would have been August of 2020 with the budget. At that point, Austin City Council made the move to remove the crime lab, which includes these DNA testing and whatnot, to remove that from the chain of command of APD, put it into a separate independent city agency. And of course, that that didn't last very long. Maybe one of the main victims of HB 1900, you know?
Right. And what I'm told is that spitting out the forensics department, which oversees the DNA crime lab, is still an achievable goal that the city has, that council thinks they can still do it maybe in the next one or two fiscal years. Kind of complex accounting, basically, that would allow the city to be in compliance with HB 1900, which, again, this is the state law that prevents cities from reducing police spending, while taking that budget item out of the department. The governing structure is still up in the air. It hasn't been finalized. It could be kind of run in partnership with Travis County, within the city itself, some independent third-party governing structure. All of that would be decided later, but it's still very much an achievable goal for the city, is what I'm told.
But of course, I mean, when that happened, that was part of the reaction from the right, you know, that the city council had drastically defunded APD. The truth is that they didn't dismantle the crime lab at all. They just changed the reporting structure.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it should be noted that this is kind of a universally agreed upon best practice to have forensics departments operated independently of law enforcement, run by scientists that don't have to report to a police chief. The Austin Police Association, Ken Cassaday, their president, supports the idea. Former Chief Manley supported the idea. I assume Chacon supports the idea. So, yeah, I mean, there's agreement this needs to happen. HB 1900 has just prevented it, or at least slowed it down.
Well, as always, we appreciate your reporting. I think several of us are definitely relieved about Prop A. What I read in the story about the sex crimes unit at APD is somewhat encouraging at this point. Thanks for your thorough coverage of that.
Sure. Thanks for reading and for having me on to talk more in depth about the story.
Well, we'll be in touch, and thanks again.
Sure. Thank you.
Up next here on co-op.org and on the 91.7 HD3 channel is Youth Spin in its new time slot. On air since 1996, Youth Spin brings varied perspectives of Austin youth through commentaries, interviews, music, and more. So please stay tuned. And that's all for this evening. Stay safe, everyone. Thanks for listening.